So, Mark's Gospel and chapter 5, verse 35. In Mark, Jesus launches this very serious, very significant, very important worldwide project that we keep going on about. But that's because we keep going back to Mark's Gospel. It is the most important project which has existed in all of time, whether before, then, or since. Because it is the building of God's kingdom. It is the Creator who made everything and saw everything decline because of our conduct in sin, coming to save us from ourselves, save us from what we have created, save us from the curse we've brought upon ourselves of death, and bring us together as a people to live forever, united under his rule once more. A rule that he expresses the Father through the Son being Jesus Christ. So Mark's Gospel is about kingdom building, it's about nation building, it's about empire building, but it's like no other. The empires of this world, the nations of this world are temporary. They pass away. They have their place in the sun and they're gone. But this is a kingdom with no end. We've seen that God had already prepared for it by having a little kingdom on the earth. We call it Israel. It comes from the name of a man originally called Jacob. But Israel was itself a temporary thing. It couldn't last forever. It could only last for a few centuries. But it was reborn, as it were, under the power of Jesus Christ. And that is what God's kingdom is. And it won't just stay in one little country. It spreads across the whole earth. And it lasts forever. Its citizens never die. Even though they get put in the ground, they are resurrected to live forever. This is what Jesus is doing. He is creating, he is bringing together a people to create a kingdom under his rule, which means under the rule of God, and which will never end. And that's what we're seeing in Mark's Gospel. That's why it's such a significant little booklet to read and think about. We are seeing the beginning of the greatest project of all history, and every Christian is called to be a part of it. It is the most amazing and beautiful thing. You might think of the great history of the UK and we last for a millennia or two. Soon be gone, no one will remember us. You think of the history of the superpower America, the last couple of hundred years or whatever she's had. Soon be gone, no one will remember. You think of China, which we might think, well, that's way more ancient than both of those. China stretches way back into history. She'll be gone. But this kingdom, the kingdom of Jesus Christ, never ends. God's society is eternal. So that's the project we're thinking about. It is a most remarkable thing. Recent passages, as you can see on the screen previously in Mark, we thought about some of the aspects of Jesus' activities to begin and to strengthen and to build that kingdom. We've seen his authority, the authority he's got, which is over beings, both visible but invisible too, those demons he dealt with. He's going to overcome everything evil that stands in the way of having a kingdom for the glory of God. We've thought about how, sure, his kingdom begins small, but that's not where it ends up. So although it's rejected often, in the end, Jesus and his kingdom will produce a multiplicity of fruit. He predicted that. He said it will start like a seed. It will start small, but it won't end small. That won't be what it is in the end. And last time, when we were dealing with the story of the woman who had the problem, we saw that Jesus was going to welcome in all who have faith in him. He doesn't build this kingdom the way often the world builds kingdoms. Look for the powerful people. Look for the significant people. He welcomes all who will put their faith in him. Even a woman in a crowd who no one else wants to know, he will stop because he wants to know her. He's not interested in the world's ways and what the world thinks. He's interested in the person who is trusting him to save. And that's what we saw. So, would you just flick that up to the black screen for me? So we've reflected on those things in recent weeks. And one of the emphases I've tried to bring out is you're seeing Jesus build the kingdom very carefully. It's a big, big project, and he's at the starting point. So he can't just sort of do it in some shambolic fashion and just sort of, well, let's see how she rolls. He is very careful in what he's doing and saying, how he's interacting with crowds and people, so that the foundation of this kingdom is a solid one and a good one. It's being done right. Now, in today's sermon, we're going to do part two of the intertwined stories of the two daughters that we started last week and that I described again a moment ago. The first is a girl. She has terminal illness. Her father is a local VIP. He is the synagogue ruler, as is mentioned a number of times in the passage. The other is an older woman. We talked about her last week. She has this distressing condition of hemorrhaging. It's a long-term condition, been over a decade with it. And Jesus helps both of them. But, as we remember, the story of his help is not just a nice tale of him being kind. And it's not even just a sort of impressive tale of him having power, the sort of power we can't imagine anywhere else. We reminded ourselves just a couple of weeks back that this Gospel of Mark is a teaching book. It's a discipling book. It's a book with lessons within it to shape and form all those who follow Jesus to understand him correctly. And so, when we think of these stories, we see Jesus' kindness, we see his power, but we try to understand, what else are we to learn from this? Why did Jesus ask his disciples, tell his disciples, command his disciples to remember this day? To hold on to it, to recount it, to tell others about it? Why did it matter to keep these stories? What's the important lessons about him and his kingdom in these events? Why did he lay this into his building project? So, as we return to the verses, we need to think about those sorts of lessons. And I think, especially what I want us to see, is something from here about Jesus' miracles today. That whatever else we see from the passage, we think about his miracles. How they contribute to the picture of his kingdom that he would want us to grasp. Now, let's dive into the verses then and start going through them. We're going to talk about the journey to Jairus' home, and then we'll go on to the raising of the girl herself when he gets to the house, and bring out a trio of final lessons after that, God willing. The journey. Jesus was asked by this VIP, very important person, a few verses back, urgently to see his daughter. She's dying. It's that serious. You've got to come. But on the way, en route, Jesus froze, didn't he? Suddenly he stopped, and all the wash of crowd stopped with him. And the reason he stopped is because one woman had reached out to touch him quietly, secretly, as he passed. But now, as the incident ends, verse 35, and you're just expecting, well, okay, let's get back on with the journey. Let's get back to the dying girl. Some men arrive. While Jesus was still speaking, back to the woman, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead. She's gone. The moment that we hear of the loss in this way of someone whom we have loved, it can be a moment of intense emotion such as we never experience anywhere else. We can find that we may uncontrollably cry. We may find that all words are snatched from us. We can find that our mind is gripped in a way we don't experience at any other time because it's grief. Grief, just as it were, suddenly pours out onto us. She's gone. Up until that moment, we still had hopes and plans and thoughts. Up until that moment, we were still having imaginary conversations. Next time we spoke to, her, him, whoever the person is. Up until that moment, we maybe, if they were unwell, were thinking, but things could improve. It might still change. Up until that moment, maybe there were past hurts, past upsets, past arguments. We were thinking, you know, it's time I resolve that. We'll get that sorted before he's gone, before she's gone. But at that moment, it's finished. No more contact. You can imagine the pain that Jairus is now in. He had come to Jesus for help. He had got Jesus' help. They were speeding to his daughter, and Jesus stopped. And now she's dead. And the sense of letdown, certainly we don't know it comes from Jairus because he doesn't say anything, but the men who have come seem to express that. Your daughter is dead, why bother the teacher? He's only a teacher. We're beyond that now. There's nothing more he can do. He can't raise the dead. Why trouble him anymore? Why get in his way anymore? Why take his time anymore? There is a sense in which it can sound dismissive. It's hardly comforting, is it? I mean, goodness, this man's daughter's just died. They're not exactly offering boundless comfort to him, are they? You wonder how irritated they were with Jesus, or how much they just wanted to write him off. Maybe they were other people from the synagogue who had a more negative view of Jesus. He's failed. Whatever's the case, they say, why bother the teacher anymore? But verse 36, ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, don't be afraid, just believe. We might have expected actually Jesus to have said something like, think again, fools, I can raise the dead. Just correct them, just say something like that. But he doesn't. He doesn't deal with them. He says he ignores the news. He just pushes that to one side. And he just looks at the Father. I mean, again, even in the telling of the story, and, you know, this story is really boiled down. I mean, it's only a couple of sentences. There's lots we're not being told here. But in the way the story is being told, isn't that tremendously powerful? The men who arrive with the news of the dead daughter are busy thinking about Jesus is no use anymore. But Jesus himself is thinking about the Father. He looks at the Father and says to him, don't fear. Believe. What did Jesus mean? Well, he wants the man to hold on to the thought that he already had when he first came to Jesus. At that point, a few verses earlier, he was certain that a touch from Jesus could raise his daughter, could lift his daughter up from her sickbed. Hold that belief, says Jesus. Do not let it go. This is not over. No matter what news you've just heard, no matter what these men think, you hold the belief you had and don't let it go at this moment. Reminds us of the storm back in chapter 4. You know, the disciples, they came to Jesus, didn't they? He was asleep in the boat. The boat is sinking. They're all convinced they're going to die. They've lost all hope. And they're waking him up and saying, don't you care that we're dying? And Jesus says, why are you afraid? Have you no faith? Well, something of that is here as well, isn't it? In a different format. Don't be afraid. Just believe. I guess one of the things learned by us from hearing that is that one of the big threats to those of us who say that we trust Jesus, that we have faith in him as our Saviour, one of the big threats to that faith is our fear. We can trust Jesus until we're in a panic. And then we let it go. Trust goes out the window. You remember Jesus explicitly flagged this as a danger. He told that parable, didn't he, back in an earlier chapter, the parable of the farmer. And the farmer is scattering seed, and there were four soil types that the seed landed on. And the middle two soil types were a description of people who apparently show faith in Jesus, who respond well to Jesus, who are interested in Jesus. And then fear takes away their interest. Just sweeps it away. So you've got one group, one soil type, and they're frightened of opposition. Jesus brings trouble. So they are drawn to him, they're interested in him, they put their trust in him, and then there's trouble, so they give up because they're scared. And then the second type, they're drawn to him, they're interested in him, but they fear difficulties. Life is full of hassle, life is full of pressure, life gets very stressful. And that just means that their faith in Jesus fades away. Fears. Fears of life or fears of trouble. As Christians, if we say we trust in the Lord Jesus, we have to be aware of the power of our fears and phobias, of our panics, which spin us out of control, that control our reactions. Later, we will be given a huge demonstration of this by one of the 12 disciples, by Peter, standing outside of Jesus' trial, spinning into a panic when a young girl speaks to him. I don't know this man. Christians have to be aware of the power of panic. Panic is a tremendously powerful thing. It's a very weird thing. It's a bit like the same way that grief can sweep over us and take control. Panic can sweep over us and take control. We'll come out with the most outrageous statements when we're in a panic, which later on we're probably either embarrassed by or apologising for or whatever. But in the moment of panic, they feel very real. We might throw accusations at other people or whatever, because we're panicking. You don't care. You're not helping. You don't understand how bad this is. We didn't feel that half an hour ago, and we probably won't feel it in half an hour or an hour's time. But at this moment, we really feel it. But we're in a panic. Our fear is flooding us, drowning us. And it's part of being human. It's how humans react to things. We can't stop it, in a sense, just like you can't stop grief. You can't stop your phobias. Well, you might be able to stop some of them, I suppose, if you use some of those treatments for getting rid of your fear of spiders or flying or whatever. But these things will come. What we have to be as Christians is prepared. That we would, in the midst of them, somewhere within us, hear that voice of Jesus that says, "Fear not, just believe." And it would help to counteract these experiences that we have. As Christians, we have to ask, what scares me most? Why does it scare me? We have to know ourselves, and then we can then pray to the Lord to say, and then when I'm tested by this, Lord, in that moment, don't let me fall. It's what Jesus said to Peter, wasn't it? Jesus didn't say to Peter, I'll tell you what, Peter, we'll skip the test, because I know it's one of your bad spots of life, you know. Dealing with sort of intimidating young females when you're stood by the fire, that's a bit scary. We'll cancel that one. You can just deal with something else instead. Peter was going to have to face it. What Jesus said to him was, this is coming. Are you going to get ready, or are you just going to, like, be hit by it? Get yourself ready. And so as Christians, yeah, we need to know ourselves, that we can pray for the Lord's help to resist the moment of temptation, to resist the moment that if a fear is realised or a panic grips, we can hold on to Christ in the midst of it. Fear not, says Jesus, just believe. He ignores what they said, we're told at the start of verse 36, ignores the news that's come. It just struck me in reading that verse that there is a small extra lesson in that. That if your particular fear is the news, learn to ignore it. I mean, there really are people who get themselves so uneasy because of the last thing they heard on the television news, on the radio news, the last thing they read on the internet, and they wind themselves up thinking about it. Oh, but I've just discovered this. They didn't even know about it an hour ago. It will make no difference to them tomorrow. But now they're worrying. And it saps their faith. Well, if that happens to you, just turn it off. Just do what Jesus did here. Just ignore what's said. You don't need to hear it. Most of what you hear on the news you can't do anything about anyway. Don't let it panic you and fear you. Focus on the Lord and what he can do. Anyway, on with the story. Verse 37. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James and John, the brother of James. So they set off, they press on. He's only going to take 3 of the 12 disciples with him. The other 9 are left dealing with the crowd or outside or whatever it may be. These 3 will be key witnesses for him. They'll reappear later in the gospel as well. What Jesus wants is a clear testimony to what's about to happen. He does want there to be witnesses. He wants there to be 3 who can formally tell what they see in the next hour or so. But he wants it limited to those 3 as well. Now you might think, well, why? I mean, you know, pack the house with witnesses. Get as many people present as possible to see all what's going on. Wouldn't it be great to have, you know, your miracles seen by as many as possible, Jesus? I mean, goodness, helping the dead daughter of a local VIP, local community leader. I mean, that'll make your name spread. You'll be known far and wide. Don't limit the number, Jesus. Pack the house out. But that's not what Jesus does with his miracles, as we've seen before. It's not what he wants to use his miracles for. We have seen previously in the gospel how Jesus hushes up events. Why? Well, miracles draw crowds, don't they? That's what they do. People love a bit of drama. They love a taste of the unexpected. Miracles can draw a crowd. And, of course, they appeal quite naturally to human longings. Everybody has wants or needs. We only have to go around this room and say, what do you particularly want? What do you particularly need at this moment? Very few people are going to go, nothing, thank you. I'm so fully satisfied with life. Everybody has wants and needs. And so when somebody comes forward with miracles, well, you get the punters coming. The crowds will flock. You know, it's like the lottery. If there's a chance of a win, give it a try, they think. The miracle workers in town, what have I got to lose? Let's go along. Miracles draw a crowd. So-called modern miracle workers know this. Just look at their advertising. Their advertising on the side of buses or whatever is designed to get people to go, oh, wow, if I go along, look what might happen. I should go. Ancient wonder workers knew the same. Now, of course, generally, as a general rule, it's all nonsense, fabrication. Over and over again, these people are exposed as charlatans and liars and cheats. They can't actually do miracles. But they put on such a good show. They put on the music so that people feel that something's happening. And they speak with passion because they're good speakers. And people feel gripped and hopeful. And they show you the success stories, which are about 0.01% of what's actually in that hall and never of anything of serious quality. But it's enough. People flock to them. There's always another punter to fleece. What's Jesus doing? He will not play the miracle worker's game. Jesus is the Son of God who does actual miracles. He really does heal people. He really does raise the dead. But he doesn't do them to draw crowds and be another miracle worker. He does them because they demonstrate what his kingdom will bring to the world. My kingdom will overcome death. My kingdom will sweep away illness. My kingdom will forgive sin. He does them to show the sort of king he is. I am truly the one upon whom is the Spirit of the Most High. And so he'll have those miracles witnessed. He'll have those miracles remembered. He'll have those miracles recorded. He'll have those miracles told. But what he will not do is use them to whip up crowds in the heat of the moment. Instead, you get this constant effect where he's playing down miracles. I'll just have you three with me on this. The rest of you, sorry, you're out of this one. He silences the voices of demons. You are the Holy One. You are the Son of God. Be quiet. I don't want you talking. Go away. He will not pander to the crowds. He will not play it for the drama and the emotion. Why? Because he knows if he does that, he will get precisely the effect we just talked about. He will get the people in groups 2 and 3 in his parable. He will get the people who will come to him because they'll love him for all the exciting stuff that's going on, and then dump him when trouble comes or pressure builds. If he just goes around doing whizzy miracles in front of everyone and getting everyone to see him, all he'll end up with isn't people with faith. He'll end up with people who enjoy the ride and who get off the ride as soon as it looks like there's any difficulty. And he's warned about that. He's looking for people of real faith, not people excited by an event. Miracles are tremendously important, and they are also a completely rubbish way to find true converts. They're important for what they show of Jesus' kingdom and who Jesus is. But if you try and spin them out as a mechanism for getting people to have faith in him, they're pretty much a disaster. Jesus constantly pushes that away. Look, I'm going to go and raise a girl now, and we're going to do this quietly. I don't want all these people with me. Now that does bring us then to the raising of the girl. And that's in verse 38. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead but asleep." When he arrives at the house, there's a big show going on. People are wailing, people are crying, people are calling. Again, you could imagine a miracle worker with a big hairdo and fancy clothes playing this for dramatic effect. "Don't worry, people. I will resurrect the girl. I am like Elijah." Jesus won't do it. "Just stop, will you, everyone," he says. "Just get out of the house. Go. This is pointless." And he doesn't say, "I am going to raise her." He just says, "She's not dead. She's just asleep." Verse 30, they laughed at him, or the phrase in some English Bibles actually translates it, laugh to scorn. They mock his ignorance and his arrogance. Notice how quickly the emotion of the crowd changes. This is the problem with crowds, isn't it? You can switch their emotion in a moment. They can move from striking grief to hollow laughter. It's exactly why Jesus will not manipulate the audience emotionally. He won't play to the gallery, because that's what you get. What he's interested in is a suffering girl and a grieving family. And that's who he's dealing with. So he kicks them all out. There's only him and the disciples and the father and mother with the corpse. And verse 31. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum." He takes her by the hand. In theory, under Jewish rules and laws now, he's become unclean. He's touched a dead body. They have to stay away from others. But as we pointed out before, it doesn't work like that with Jesus. There's nothing outside of Jesus that has power over him. The power comes out from him to make everything else different. So it is here. It's not him becoming unclean. It's the girl being cleaned. It's the girl being raised back up. And the words he speaks to her are not some sort of magical words. He just speaks in the local Aramaic dialect. He just talks to her in her own tongue. And he says to her, "Little girl, get up. Time to get up, dear." He talks to her as though she really is asleep. Mark translates it for his readers and hearers, and when he turns it into the Greek that he translates it in a way which links us back to some words Jesus spoke earlier, echoes some words from earlier, which was to the paralyzed man who rose from his bed. I say to you, the miracles join together and they give a picture of the kingdom that Jesus has. Well, verse 32, immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. I mean, again, you immediately see the contrast, don't you, with the con men. You know, you don't have to watch many YouTube videos of healers to see them healing people who have got some sort of problem walking or whatever, and they're sort of struggling up with the con man's sort of big burly helpers sort of helping them to take 5 steps across the stage or whatever. This girl has been dead. She's been terminally ill, and then she's died, but she just stands up and walks around. She's fully back. Mark notes that she's 12 years old. I mean, that gives us a nice picture of sort of thinking of her age and everything, doesn't it? And we realise that she's on the edge of womanhood. But it also ties her to the older woman earlier. She was ill for 12 years. That number 12 draws part of the intertwining of the two stories. This girl was born just as the woman's suffering had started. For both families, 12 had become a sad number. For the woman, it was the years of pain. For this Jairus and his family, it had become the age of death. 12 should have been Israel's good number, the number of the tribes, the number of the sons, the number of Jacob's sons. But it had become a bad number in the land, a symbol of how bad Israel herself had become. But Jesus turns it all around. And she's alive. But what does he do? Verse 43, he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. You see, he will not play this miracle. He's done it because of the sort of king he is and the sort of kingdom he's building and his compassion to a grieving family. He's not doing it to play the crowds. So he says to them, what has happened here? Oh, people will know that she's around again, obviously. But you keep it to yourselves. And in fact, he says, you should give her something to eat now. I mean, I'm assuming that he's not implying that Jairus and his wife are completely incompetent parents and can't work out when their children might need feeding. I assume that what's happening is that Jesus is saying, why don't you have a family meal now? He's just keeping them all in the house. Instead of them immediately going outside saying, she's alive! He says, I think you go through to the kitchen now and we'll get something to eat. He just normalises the whole situation and then he can slip away. Let the emotion of the crowd live with the rumours of what went on. Well, as we wrap up, let's think about 3 lessons just from this, just to finish up. Let's think firstly about how Jesus delayed Jairus. Because he did, didn't he? They were pushing through the crowd, they were coming to the daughter, and then Jesus stopped. And we could misunderstand that. People might say, why did he do that? I mean, do you think Jesus was trying to make it all more dramatic? Do you think, he was letting the girl die so that then he could raise her and it would all look more impressive? People would be wowed. No, that would be a horrible thought, wouldn't it? Jesus is not manipulative. He's not going to let a girl die so that he looks better. His actions are always about love and faith. Going through that crowd, he met another daughter who had needs and he had to help her, the woman. And so he stopped to help her. And he's doing it, and that delay as well was because he's looking to build faith in him, that people will know that he does always do what's right, and even when it gets dark, they must trust him. As he said to Jairus, don't be scared by what's happened here. You just keep believing what you already believed. No, it's that delay. It wasn't about him trying to be manipulative or something. It was him being loving, and it was him demonstrating that his kingdom works by faith, so hang on to him. His lesson to the disciples and the others in all of this is, trust me. They're going to need it, aren't they? The disciples are really going to go through the mill very soon. The kingdom is going to look like it's a disaster. Jesus himself is going to be dead. But the kingdom gets built through such dark periods when God overcomes even the worst of enemies. So Jesus' dealings with Jairus, they're not game playing. They're him showing love, and they're just how his kingdom works. His kingdom will always rely upon faith. That's how it's built. And so you'll always get these incidents of faith. As Jesus says to Jairus, the point is not to go into despair and say, everything's gone wrong, she's dead. But actually to keep holding on to him and trusting him. And that is a reminder to our own faith, isn't it? Secondly, the lesson is that faith in Jesus, if you have your trust in him, it may require you to go places you don't want to go, where you feel like you've lost all hope. Jairus had to. The disciples will have to. Christians find those points come. The disciples will feel it at the cross. Jairus feels it in the midst of that crowd. You may face it at some point, or have done already. Now, with Jairus, it's brief. He will only see his daughter as a corpse for a matter of seconds or minutes before Jesus raises her. The disciples, they'll suffer a bit longer with it. They'll have to live through the whole of Saturday thinking that Jesus is dead and it's all over. But even for that moment, feel for Jairus. For a moment, he is in darkness. The Lord asks the same of Christians. There are points where we descend into dark places, and they are dark. They're not pretend dark, they are truly dark. They feel like too much for us. What does a Christian do in the midst of that? You do what Jesus said here. Fear not, just believe. You don't play the world's game and just sort of whistle through it, singing happy songs and hoping everything will be brighter tomorrow. Or hiding your sorrows in some way. It's a sad place. But in the midst of it, you hold on to Christ. Remember, if you were with us at the Zoom meeting last Sunday evening, James Goodman was talking about this from the Psalms, Psalm 42. And he said, there are times when Christians need psalms to sing which are sad. Because sometimes we're sad. But they help us to hold on by faith in the midst of the sadness. So faith may require you to go to a place where you lose all hope except holding on to Christ. But then the thing you encourage yourself with is the end of the story, isn't it? That if you hold on to Christ, then life can return. Faith brings life. We trust Jesus for life. His kingdom gives life. It's what it does. And this miracle expresses that. It gives us the reason why we hold on to him. One of the things that's so lovable about this story of the private resurrection is that it's also normal at the end. You know, at the end, the girl gets up. She's sort of walking around the house, probably a bit dazed and sort of, where have I been? And then they go and have a family meal. Or at least they go and feed her. And it's all so ordinary. It's just like when Jesus stepped into the house and they're all wailing and crying. He said, will you all please stop? Because she's just asleep. It's so lovable how ordinary he makes it all in the end. Because that, in a way, is the best picture of all of what Jesus gives you in his kingdom. He just gives you back life. In his kingdom, it's not mega exciting thrills all the time and mega exciting spills all the time, though getting near God does have that element to it. But in the end, he just gives you life back. I think one of the things we should learn from that is just never to downplay the ordinary, everyday life we live as Christians. It's not the sort of dramatic events that form our anecdotes and the big deeds for the Lord which really count. It's actually just living for him every day. We love our big stories, you know. We recount them about the mega Christians who go off and do this, that and the other, and it's all very amazing. But actually, A Christian who just lives their life for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, faithful to the Lord, loving the Lord, where they are in their everyday life, and holds on by faith through the dark times. That is a beautiful thing. Like the end of this story. You know, be ambitious to live an ordinary life for the glory of God. And enjoy every good gift he gives, however small, and hold on to him by faith. There are times for big deeds for the Lord, of course there are, and it's not wrong to love those who do them. But most Christians' lives aren't that. And that's a beautiful thing, because the Lord gives us back life in a sin-spoiled world and helps us to live it. And that's something to rejoice in.